Blog Talk Radio.
Talk about the nature of our people, what is going on with them, how can we act and become more responsible, more conscious, and react accordingly. And to do this, we need to fundamentally ask this particular one question. And I think it's a philosophical question, but it's an important question. It has many implications. And discuss some of the implications with us, we have Brother Anthony, Brother Haki, and Brother Robert Moses. We have two more panelists that will be on with us later to discuss this question, and we'd like to have our listening audience to call in at 323-679-0841. 323-679-0841. Make sure you hit number one if you'd like to be heard. Once you have hit that number one, your line will show up on that board, and we will acknowledge you by your last four numbers. But we had this philosophical question that many serious organizers and people in general must often wonder, and that question is, do the people really want to know the truth? Looking at all of the contradictions, the suffering, the various forms of oppression, the games that are constantly being played on humanity, in particular on African people, people who are the most oppressed, sometimes you ask yourself, why are our people keeping up with the okie-doke? So we want to start off with a serious discussion, and we'll start off with Brother Haki with the fundamental question. Brother Haki, with all of the issues and contradiction things going on with our people, seem like more things change and more they remain the same. There are just so many crazy things going on in our society. And one of the questions you often ask, why is it that many people continue to put up with these games that other folks are playing with them? Do the people really want to know the truth? Give me your philosophical position on the question first and foremost.
Well, the short answer in terms of the inaction among African Americans has a lot to do in terms of the propagandistic machine that exists, or level of disinformation pumped out to the people in terms of people confused. And this is a very long and intense process. This process actually started back in the 16th century, 1622 to be precise, when Pope Gregory XV actually implemented the concept of a propaganda, or the use of terms of being able to deceive people. It was very important at that point in time in terms of the church being able to deceive people, because in order for it to execute its power, in order for it to control, it had to keep people dumb or keep them naive in terms of the reality that was that affected their lives. And so therefore, he implemented this process in terms of propaganda. Now, keep in mind, this process has not stopped. In fact, in the 19th century, then Frank Lutz, a Republican pollster, also picked up this process in terms of being able to deceive people, in terms of utilizing, you know, particular words in terms of deceiving people. But people may think what he said means one thing, in reality, it means something totally different. And this process was also picked up by Lee Atwater, who's also a Republican strategist, in particular for Ronald Reagan and George Bush. And he also, you know, moved it up a notch in terms of ability to deceive people. Now, when we talk about the ability to deceive people, we should be very, very clear that the people in power, that 1% of the population who controls everything, understand quite precisely the power of disinformation and the ability to deceive people, and to the extent that they're actually dumbfounded. They really don't understand exactly what's going on. In fact, in the most recent lexicon, when we talk about the ability to deceive people, there's a word now in local lexicon called agnotology. Agnotology is the ability to actually deceive people. That's a science in terms of tricking people. And so now people don't know. It's often a result of, you know, a very scientific process in terms of making sure that any information they may be privy to is sort of countered by more disinformation, a greater amount of disinformation, so it's confused them in terms of what the reality is. And as a consequence, they subsequently give up and start to believe in the propaganda. Now, just in terms of how serious this whole propaganda process is as related to the United States, as one of the things, when I talk about lexicon, there's a word currently used by the upper class or the ruling class called Schadenfreude. Now, Schadenfreude is a German word which originated in Germany, and what it simply means is that people take pride in their ability to deceive or to trick other people. Now, that says a lot just in terms of the mindset of the powerful. One of the things is that certainly in a society in which you have this disparity when it comes to wealth, when you have 1% of the population controlling 60% of the wealth, it's clearly you got a problem. And the question is, you have to do something in terms of making sure that 90% never come to the realization that they're being shortchanged. And so, therefore, this whole process in terms of propaganda disinformation is very pertinent. And it's directed specifically at the community in terms of media, in terms of radio, newsprint, and so forth. And so, therefore, there's consistent lines that are articulated over and over again so as to give it credibility. But as we'll talk about later, one of the things that we understand that even though that these lies are consistent in terms of the content,
that there's an ebb and flow in terms of how you tell lies. See, if I lie to you, one of the things that the capitalist class understand, that if the capitalist class is going to lie to you, then one of the things they don't want to do is to scare you so much to the point where you actually works against them in terms of you actually absorbing the lies. So what they do is when they lie to you, it's always followed by stories talking about our solution to what we perceive as the professed problem. And so therefore, if I say that we have Iraq, that they're going to bomb us, if we don't do, they're going to bomb us, then I understand that my follow-up to Iraq is going to bomb us. I'm going to tell the people, listen, but we're going to bomb them first. We're going to destroy them. We're going to reduce their country to rubble. This is what we're going to do. So it makes the propaganda much easier for people to swallow because, you know, tricking people, just outright deception, doesn't always exist. And particularly, the more intelligent you are and the smaller the group, then the propaganda is not likely to work. So they're very scientific in terms of the application in terms of propaganda. So a lot of our people, unfortunately, are caught up in a situation which they truly don't understand. And so the struggle for our people is to break that bond. And to begin that process in terms of wanting to know by starting, first of all, foremost, by reading and asking questions. So that's what we have to do. But that's in a short, in a word, that is part of the problem in terms of why there's so much inaction, so much ambivalence in terms of our people when we come out dealing with a lot of problems that we're confronted with.
Okay, so based upon your conclusion of what you had just stated, Brother Hackey, for our listening audience, they won't be sure that your position is, do the people really want to know the truth? And you would say either, what would be your question, yes or no? We understand based upon your analysis how they have been deceived for not knowing the truth, but if they know the truth, they really want to know the truth, yes or no?
Well, it comes down to a class dynamic. In terms of people who are read, well read, or people who are college educated, or people who are just in the know, clearly they understand the irony. They understand the problems peculiar to the society, and they feel like it's not in their interest to even deal with those. So in essence, we talk about people who think that they're pragmatic. When on one hand, they consciously they understand what's going on. But subconsciously, their position is that I'm not going to deal with it. I'm not going to give it any relevance because I'm going to pretend like it doesn't exist. But they do understand that, but they feel like it's not in their interest to even acknowledge these problems because somehow they think they're going to be protected as society deteriorates. Of course, the history is adamantly opposed to that notion that somehow, because you're ignorant or because you don't want to express what goes on, that somehow you're going to be saved. They say the same thing in Nazi Germany. The same thing in fascist Italy. The same people who knew what was going on and kept quiet under the guise that they'll be safe if they just keep quiet were sadly mistaken. So history is very, very profound when it comes to punishing people, you know, as a result, you know, inaction. So there is no escape in ignorance or pretending you don't know is not an excuse. Now, in terms of the masses of folks, clearly most of the masses of folks don't understand what's going on. They really don't. There's a tremendous amount of money they pop into television, and they control the images. And even when it comes to the music, the images are very, very, or the lyrics are very, very tightly controlled. And the point being is that they do understand and they empower in terms of telling people the same thing over and over again. In fact, the larger the crowd that they propagandize, the more successful they are. Because if you can get most of the people in that group to believe a certain fallacy, things that are not real, then they have an impact on other people in their groups. And so, therefore, propaganda is more successful in terms of the larger group. Propaganda is less effective when it comes to small groups, in particular because people have more opportunity to critique, to actually think about what they're being introduced to. And so, therefore, yeah, the masses of people, clearly those who haven't had the opportunity to read for whatever reason or haven't had the opportunity to go to school, probably don't understand the complexities in terms of society, and they really don't know. And so when you try to tell them, the reality is that they perceive you as a problem and not understanding that's a much general problem. So in that case, you got to say that, you got to conclude that people are acting based upon what they know. And in that sense, it's not their fault. If in fact they're internalizing so much propaganda that they don't even really know what the truth is, even despite the suffering, the lack of quality education, lack of food, lack of housing. Even those situations impact on a lot of people. To poor people, they often don't understand the implications for the reason who's doing it, and so this is the nature of propaganda.
Okay, we'll move to the next question to our Brother Anthony. Brother Anthony, once her Sister McKinney make the statement, she said that people really don't want to know the truth because to know the truth and make them responsible. Now, what's your position on this question for tonight? Do the people really want to know the truth?
I think the masses of the people want to know the truth. However, most of them don't know the truth because of the control that the bourgeoisie has over the media and our educational system, which is the source of the basic knowledge that people have in order to conduct their lives. Let's see, to give an example of that. Now that is not to say all the people are confused. There is a sector of our intelligentsia that's very conscious and knows what's going on. However, they choose to to align with the ruling bourgeoisie. These are the reactionary intelligentsia that are in the service of capitalism and neocolonialism in all of its manifestations. Pernille Joseph being Bill Gates being examples of that sort of trend. However, because of the control of the bourgeoisie of the mass media and educational systems in the African diaspora and on the African continent as well, a lot of the educated Africans are very confused, and therefore they are misled into not wanting to know the truth, especially when they have mechanisms in place where they can escape from it, such as sports and entertainments and various forms of drugs.
Okay, we'll move to our brother Robert Moses. What is your position? Do the people really want to know the truth?
Well, that's the question. That is the question. What is the truth? From a philosophical standpoint, it just depends on how deep you want to go in terms of truth. There is a spirit which embodies us and which gives us life, and that spirit has been harnessed and tamed, and our life displayed about what we can do in terms of humanity and to serve humanity. And that was embodied in Jesus Christ. And so he said he was the way, the truth, and the life, and nobody comes, there would be no progress without love. And basically that was what he was all about. And so we find a situation where the intelligentsia is a strata. It comes from a lot of different classes. It's not one class, it's a strata. It's a strata of classes, and it's the intelligentsia. So Karl Marx himself was from the ruling class. Ultimately, he was from the bourgeoisie, but he was part of the intelligentsia. So the intelligentsia, those people who were seeking enlightenment and, in their various professions, and they come to knowledge. What makes us different is that we represent a class that is oppressed, and therefore our ideas are the ideas that society needs in order to progress. We are the key to the future in terms of society because we are class for ourselves. We're not just recognizing that we're a class and saying we're a class in ourselves, but we're a class for ourselves. We're advocating for our interests, and truth is being discovered daily. Every day I discover a little more truth. Like, for instance, that Israel, the only way you can get married in Israel is with a rabbi. That means there's no civil rights for people in Israel except for Jews. And that's not even civil rights. That's religious rights because it's just a theocracy. So, I don't know. Truth is being revealed every day. And I'm learning. So it's an ever pursuit.
And last but not least, we have with us Brother Bam Bushi Shungo. We will go to Brother Brown Shungo and ask his position on position of do he believe the people really want the truth. I know since McKinney stated earlier, and one of the documentaries she did was that the people do not really want to know the truth, because to know the truth means make you become responsible. How would you respond to that, Brother Bamboshi?
Good evening, Brother Africa.
Good evening.
Also, good evening to all your guests today, and thank you for raising this philosophical question on what is the truth and do people want to know the truth. I would tend to think that since truth is objective, truth is something that exists, whether you want to know it or not, then the essential question is, how do one, you put an interpretation on the truth so it has a significance, and two, how do you react to the truth? And in essence, what I hear a lot of people saying who say people don't want to know the truth is that people are afraid of what actions and what responsibility comes with knowing the truth, what they will have to do if they know the truth. And I can see that very objectively, because if you know, for example, that you're oppressed, then you cannot go along anymore by saying everything's all right. And the fact that you know you are oppressed means that you have to now face your oppression and do something about it. This is the essence of the problem. So we're saying that truth is objective. Water is H2O no matter where you find it. Even if somebody wished to come along and say it's something other than H2O, if you put it to the test, it's still H2O. So in that sense, truth is something that is. It's objective. Now, there are people who can subjectively try to reinterpret it, to say it means something else. But the truth is the truth. Even as I think Brother Robert Moses alluded to, that the Bible says, seek ye the truth, and the truth will make you free. Our problem is, how do we, one, look at objectivity? How do we come to realize that something is? How do we philosophically face the fact that things are material, and that these material things interact with each other and have a reaction and a profound change constantly going on amongst itself and each other? How do we do this? And not only how do we do this, but how do we use this to change our minds, change our thinkings, come to understand to understandings? How do we say that if something is material, then whatever it does, whatever reaction it causes, we look for that reaction, we look for the material cause of that reaction. If people are oppressed, then they're not oppressed because they have bad luck. They're not oppressed because they're born under the wrong sign or somebody didn't bless them. They're oppressed for material causes because other people are exploiting them, are committing genocide against them. Those are material things. So, therefore, you're looking for the causes of these material reality in the material world. And I'm not sure if people are understanding what I'm trying to say, but what I'm trying to say is that truth is objective, and that once you face the truth, you have to react. And to react to truth implies that you now have a responsibility.
Now, based upon what Bambosha just stated, and your daily struggles going through the various communities of our people, do y'all ever find situations where there seem to be, at least perception-wise, when you look at the behavior of the people, and when you're engaging with them, they seem to have a tendency to not to want to deal with reality? And if so, how do you create the climate or the conditions to make them come aware of the importance of, you know, we must engage in whatever those factors are or forces are that's causing that reality to be, in order, if they want to change it and make it better? Brother Hakeem?
Well, you know, Brother Africa, one of the things, one of the unique characters when we start talking about propaganda or disinformation or the ability to deceive people, one of the very interesting concepts, this whole concept of this organization of Trump, and in other words, this ability to get people, despite their suffering, to actually, you know, want to be a part of that which extorts them. So in the course of talking to people, in terms about the problems that they exist, there is this propensity for a lot of people to simply dismiss it. And I think a lot of that has to do with the fact that this desire in terms of wanting to belong is so strong among a lot of people that they don't want to believe that, in fact, those things that you articulate in terms of injustice, you talk in terms of suffering, in terms of lack of access to homes or to houses or shelter or to food or to quality education, I think they want to believe that somehow that the default is somehow theirs. I don't think they want to see that's a system in place that facilitates this kind, this whole process in terms of the blanket denial of large numbers of people in society. So I think that's sort of the problem. I think that problem also speaks in terms of self-esteem. I think one of the things about the society is very, very good in terms of teaching people to be to not only internalize their own pain, but to get them to believe in fact that any sense of injustice is self-inflicted. In other words, if I don't have food to eat, it's my own fault. It's because whatever. Maybe I don't have my education's not good enough, or maybe I don't work long enough hours, or maybe my neighborhood was bad. I mean, they have a myriad of reasons in terms of justifying why they're suffering, but they never get to the systemic issues in terms of the system being a system in place that in fact is responsible for the suffering. So they never get to that point. One of the things is that we can't discount the whole question in terms of language. When we start talking about people's resistance in terms of even acknowledge, you know, the problems that that impacts on their lives. One of the things that's interesting is I think about often, you know, when you listen to politicians talk and how they articulate that, and you think about people who sit back who may not be as sophisticated as others, who sit there and listen to what politicians are saying, whereas they don't fully appreciate what is being said. For example, often you hear politicians come on television and they talk about, you know, full employment. Now, for the brother and sister out there who's not well-read, he or she may conclude that full employment is a good thing. Well, with that understanding, in the capitalist mindset, full employment has nothing to do in terms of actually making sure everybody has a job or desiring everyone to have a job. Full employment has nothing to do with that. In the capitalist lexicon, full employment means that hiring enough people to the extent that it doesn't impact on profits. To the point that it impacts on profits, you have to lay people off, you have to get rid of people. So this is what full employment means in terms of the capitalist lexicon. But a lot of people, particularly who are not as sophisticated, may believe that they're talking about something that's going to benefit them. And so in that sense, it gives the message of people hope that, in fact, if these people actually understand or acknowledge that they're suffering out there and they're going to actually create jobs for us, when, in fact, politicians are not talking about creating jobs for you. As a matter of fact, they're talking about the exact opposite. They're talking about reducing jobs. And so, unfortunately, a lot of people don't understand that. Also, a lot of times when you look at news, people talk about the underclass. You know, and I don't think the working class people, the lumping proletariat, really understands what they mean by underclass. What the implications of underclass? What does that conceptually mean? Well, when they talk about underclass, they're talking about the worst of humanity.
or as some would call, the dregs of humanity. And people don't necessarily understand that they're talking about you and me, and people don't necessarily understand that, which is understandable, you know, with the fact that if you don't read and you're not used to that term, you never heard it before, you don't know what an underclass is. You probably think they're talking about somebody else, someone who doesn't have a job, you see. So this is the problem. And last but not least, let me just throw this in real quickly. One of the things I think is important also to understand is that this whole concept in terms of democracy, a lot of people, particularly the rank and file, have the perception that, in fact, democracy exists. Now, if you believe that democracy exists, if you believe that somehow the system is egalitarianistic, that is concerned about the good of people in society, then if you believe that it's based upon anything concrete, it's based upon only because you're being taught that democracy exists in America. Of course, you and I understand democracy doesn't exist in America. It never has. It never was. It wasn't designed. Even in fact, when you talk about the Constitution, the preamble talks about the Republic. It doesn't talk about democracy. And people don't understand that when we talk about democracy, when we talk about the philosopher Democritus, his position is very clear. Democracy is the running government for the benefit of the few, not the many. And so people don't understand that. So therefore, when you talk to brothers and sisters in the street who are ill-informed, who simply don't understand, who maybe not read because they don't have the opportunity to read, they have a totally different concept in terms of what they're hearing on TV versus what you're saying. And so what you're saying really doesn't resonate or have any credibility because they've been told on TV constantly that democracy exists. So this is the fundamental problem that we have in terms of trying to get people to understand that what you hear on TV and what actually exists, and this is based upon their own life, you know, is something that can only be engaged once you read. And the only solution is to read because you can tell people, you can tell people, you can tell people. But if they don't read it, then they never come to the religion what's going on. I think to some extent, as the social situation, political, economic situation deteriorates, I think it's going to compel a lot of people to maybe think about it. Whether or not they would adequately understand precisely what's going on remains to be seen. But I think that as a prelude in terms of understanding the system, in terms of being able to move forward, then you have to, I think the solution is to read.
Brother Anthony, what is your position in terms of your practical experiences engaging in various communities, particularly oppressed communities, when you engage in the people and you seem to detect certain behaviors or tendencies where people seem to want to avoid their present realities? How do you deal with that? Where does that come from? Because, again, it leads up to the question of do people really want to know the truth?
Well, my experience is that some people do and some people don't. And I think a piece of it is that some people are so caught up and so thoroughly brainwashed by the educational system and the media that they believe that if they work hard enough, if they overcome their own deficiencies through their own effort, that they could be wealthy, that they could aspire to be in the bourgeoisie's shoes, to be part of the ruling class, to have the multi-millions that they have. The reality is that most people won't be able to. And I think a lot of people spend a lot of time in this society trying to escape from reality rather than deal with it. Primarily, the escape mechanism consists of sports, entertainment, and drugs, not necessarily in that order. And let's see, and the truth is very painful. But it becomes the starting point for being able to deal with the root causes of our oppression. But that entails a lot of work, and I think unfortunately a lot of people are brainwashed into believing that sort of work is negative. And so I think it's the nature of society, but I think the people that truly want change and see the contradictions clearly that this does not benefit the majority of the people, understand and really want to change, but they're confused as to which way to go because there's so many different organizations out there promising, you know, deliver so many different things. And, you know, and there's the confusion, and it's the task of Pan-Africanist organizations to clear up that confusion.
Okay. Now, I want to raise this question with Brother Moses, but I'd be real interested for my audience and the rest of y'all to chime in on this question because it deals back again to trying to get to people, trying to get people to come to realization of their realities and what are the forces that are really making the things the way they are. And if they are to change the things the way they are to something different, there has to be some kind of understanding that this is objectively, this is where we are. Now, for you, Brother Robert Moses, many people use or lack to perceive that there is a divine plan. There is a divine plan for all people and be designed by the Creator, come from the Creator. And therefore, we should let the Creator plan take its place, you know, let it work itself out, follow his lead. Do you see that as a form of getting people not to want to deal with reality? Or do you see this as this is a part of someone understanding what the truth is?
Well, let me first say there's a divine spirit, a divine spirit. I mean, there's a force in the universe. And, you know, I know through prayer that it's a mind regulator and a heart fixer, and it's a peace that surpasses all understanding. But in terms of some kind of omnipotent, omnipresent, some kind of authoritarian figure running the planet, and that, no. The people and the people alone make history. And so the plans have worked out. You know, God has been an idea that has just sustained humanity throughout centuries, because we use it as a term that reflects unity and reflects a truth that is not human and that, you know, that is everlasting. So it's a concept that we use, but in terms of, you know, to actually being some figurehead or something that's controlling things, you know, the people and the people alone make history. And I want to say on the question of democracy, democracy is when people get together and decide their fate. They collectively decide their fate. That's why originally communism was called social democracy, because society, you know, it's a social order getting together and deciding their fate. But now the bourgeoisie, the only class, likes to equate democracy with electoral politics because it disguises their rule. And they're able to do whatever they want to do, and meanwhile we're focused on voting and electing officials and stuff. And so the electoral politics. Lenin pointed out, B.I. Lenin, the Russian revolutionary, pointed out in Left Wing Communism and Infantile Disorder that, you know, there's a lot of people that the left movement tends to negate power. The need for electoral politics altogether, and that's a tendency, a left-wing infantile tendency to ignore electoral politics because the masses are mesmerized or hypnotized by electoral politics, and they equate democracy with electoral politics. That's why they were able to use that as a weapon against Omar Gaddafi. You know, they've used it as a weapon against any progressive situation which is not totally a carbon copy of the U.S.'s government. And so democracy is, you know, is the only class will use any form of government. You know, that's why they're in Saudi Arabia. They use any form of government, but they prefer democracy or electoral politics, what they call democracy. They prefer that form because people are placated. A lot more people are satisfied, and their rule is more stable, and they can last longer under that kind of system. It gives the people a sense of freedom or something, as if they made a decision or something. And meanwhile, the ruling class is just having its way.
Okay. So, Brother Bamboshi, I'd like to raise a question with Brother Bamboshi. In terms of this question, what happens when this whole issue of idealism come in contact or conflict with materialism? Ultimately, who wins out? Brother Bambushi?
Yes, yes.
Yes, yes. When you're talking about this whole question of, yeah, when we talk about this whole question of people want to know the truth and trying to deal with realities, a lot of time we are talking about the battle between idealism versus materialism. And my question to you is, ultimately, in a society where idealism comes in contact with materialism, ultimately speaking, who normally wins out?
Well, I think that for me, I'm a materialist. And so I would say that ultimately materialism wins out. But there are people who are not materialists, and many of those people give very little credence to the material world. And for them, the opposite is what wins out. And I've seen people argue this in many ways. They've even argued that they're materialists, but materialism is a plenum of forces and tension, and that by forces, it includes spirits, etc. And while I would tend to disagree with them, I would think if you use that analysis, then you would come to different interpretations of reality than I might. So for me, I think that being a materialist implies that you look first to matter, and that matter is the prime reality, which means it's the first reality. It does not mean it's the only reality. But when you look to analyze situations, you go for the material, look at the material, the objective material reality first. And then after that, and only after that, do you look for other possibilities and possible causes.
Okay. We have with us an African youth leader here on the board now. We'd like to welcome our brother Jabari and brother Jabari. We're speaking on this question, do the people really want to know the truth? What would be your take on the question? What is your philosophical position on the question?
Hello to the other distinguished panelists, and thank you for this opportunity. And in regards to knowing the truth, it's very interesting that you raise this question, because we live in a society of a lot of distortion, because we know that with the media agents, the agent of reinforcement that reflects whatever the dominant group in society is, whatever their agenda is. And when you have a situation like that, it's easy to be bombarded by a lot of misconceptions, a lot of half-truths and outright lies, where fiction is being reality. And in that case, I would say that it's a matter to what each individual thinks, because I can't say that the case is always true for everyone, because in some cases, some people may want to know the truth, while in others, it's just a matter of being comfortable, long as I can make money, maintain that so-called American dream, and be comfortable with that.
Okay. We'd like to let our listening audience know that in the next 10 minutes, please be patient with us. We will open up our phone lines at 323-679-0841. Y'all listen to Africa on the Move. And we're just having some discussion, philosophical discussion on this question of whether or not the people want to know the truth. Because we believe that that is a fundamental question that we must resolve if we truly talk about organizing our community and making our people become more active toward participating, towards alleviating their suffering. So we would like to hear your position on that, your position on that, and later on during the program, we will talk about the other fundamental question today is, once the people know the truth, how does that play out in reality? Does that automatically mean by knowing the truth, where they act the truth out, where they begin to become active in terms of participating towards alleviating that suffering. All right. So, again, the next 10 minutes.
Brother Africa, can I weigh in?
Yes, Brother Hackey, go ahead.
Listen, I got to weigh in on this question in terms of the role of religion in terms of facilitating idealism. One of the things that when we talk about the complicit role of the Catholic Church in terms of its ability, you know, to deceive people, I mean, it's very, very important that we understand that. So when we talk about this role in terms of Jesus, historically we understand Jesus was a man. But then we also historically understand that the Catholic Church did a good job in terms of taking this ordinary man, this man with a message, and making him as though he's in fact the Son of God, that in fact he's an extension of God. So in getting people to understand that or believe that, that the Catholic Church understood, or at least the popes understood, that they had more control over if in fact they got people to believe that. By having people to believe that, they in fact control the narrative, which controls the way people think. And so it makes people much more controllable in terms of the messages that the Catholic Church want to get out. So, and this process continued even the times that people were we were enslaved in the colonial era. The first thing it did in terms of the church, the Christian church in particular, the first thing they did was to set guidelines in terms of exactly how we would go about, you know, advocating Christianity to the African people. And so they were very, very circumspect in terms of what you can say, how you can say it, and so forth. One of the tenets in terms of Christian church was that you should always obey your master. Very, very interesting for people who are enslaved to be taught that they should obey their master. Secondly, told that, listen, don't worry about it. You'll get your just desserts, you know, once you leave this planet and go to heaven, you'll get yours. And so this, and also, to a large extent, it taught people, and it is even concurrent today, it taught people that to be truly liberated, it has nothing to do with political systems, that being free or liberated has to do with in your mind. There's a notion that I'm free if I think that I'm free. If I think that I'm going to heaven when I die, then I'm really free. And so therefore, things like politics, things like food, shelter, education, and so forth, in the minds of a lot of Christians is esoteric. Those are things that are important. And so the kind of liberal idea in terms of where we've got in this more existential kind of world that they live in doesn't prepare them to deal with the material world that exists. And so they can look at injustice and suffering and poverty and not give it a second thought. They're more apt to say the suffering and poverty that people experience is their own fault, because if they believed as they did, then it would be okay. And this is the fundamental problem. Now, there's a young man in Maryland, his name was Kenneth Ford. This guy come from, a strong Christian background. Now, here's the problem. He was indoctrinated to believe America right or wrong. In fact, his family believed that the government should be elevated over the Creator, and so therefore it gives you some indication in terms of just how liberal his understanding of the world was. Now, Kenneth Ford worked for the National Security Agency as a language analyst. This guy's job was to spy on people in the Middle East. He spoke Arabic. So his thing was to translate what people are saying in Arabic. Now, what happened was that just prior to 9/11, Dick Cheney came to the young man and asked him, listen, what do you have for me? Well, the young man told him, I don't have anything for you. Well, once later, Dick Cheney came back to again. Dick Cheney asked him, what do you have for me? The young man, Kenneth Ford, said, I don't have anything for you. He came back a third time. He said, what do you have for me? The young man said, I don't have anything for you. Well, this irritated Cheney. To the young man, Kenneth Ford didn't understand that when they're paying him that six-figure salary, that wasn't to be honest. See, he had this assumption that, in fact, America was honest, that it was ethical, that it was bound by morality. He thought that. But because he didn't understand the nature of the game, he ended up being set up by Cheney and the FBI, who in turn left FBI's top files in his house. He broke into his house, left the files in his house, came back to his house the next day, raided the house, found his house, arrested him. They tried him. Because his lawyer was able to prove that being with the NSA, he wouldn't have access to FBI files. But the judge stipulated that he would be tried without prejudice, which means he could be tried a second time for the same charge, so there'd be no double jeopardy. The second time he was convicted, he ended up with 3 years in prison for something he didn't do. Now, if the jury that convicted this young fellow also believes that America is in fact a moral place. And so, therefore, they didn't deal with it in terms of materiality, in terms of the injustice, the suffering that permeates society. They have an idea in terms of what this country is all about, and they acted on that. And as a consequence, injustice was done. Now, keep in mind, you can't have a democracy if the people, A, are not enlightened, B, if the people don't have a stake in terms of what's going on, and C, if they can't maneuver to make changes to that. This is a danger in terms of liberal thinking when you think that just because you think something that's okay, that is reality, when in fact the reality is something different.
Okay. I'm going to ask all y'all to weigh in on this one question. Then we're going to take our break, and when we come back, we're going to open up our phone lines to our listening audience. We have a line lined up. Again, to our listening audience, make sure that if you would like to have any question or comment, make sure you hit number one so we can acknowledge your last four number. But before we go into our break, I would like for all y'all to respond to this one thing, this one particular question. Do y'all all believe that God has blessed America? Every time I turn on TV, I hear these politicians, I hear the president, I hear a bunch of Africans running around talking, God bless America. We're going to start from the top and come on down. Start with you, Anthony. What's your position? Do you believe that God has blessed America?
No. I mean, from my understanding of Christianity, God is a just God. And he detests injustice. And this society was built on injustice, first by stealing the land from the American Indian and using Africans as cheap labor to develop it. And, the principles that undergird this society are based on exploitation of one group of human beings for the benefit of another group of human beings. And if people study who purport to be Christians, study Christianity carefully, they would not fall for that. Christianity teaches that God, is a God of justice. And that he is against oppression. And if people actually understood Christianity, they would be against the situation they're in presently. But unfortunately, the way Christianity is taught, it's kind of like used as an escape mechanism to relieve people of their responsibility for their actions. Because if you believe without careful study that God takes care of everything, that kind of like relieves you of responsibility for your own actions. And too many people fall for that, and that creates the confusion that exists, in this society, and throughout the diaspora for that matter.
Brother Hackey, has God blessed America?
Only if God is a sadist. That's just some propagandistic crap that the ruling elite use in terms of deceiving the mass of the people. And I think it's pretty relevant, germane at least to the Catholic. I mean, to religion, as a lot of people have embraced a lot of these falsehoods that has no basis in reality. So I think it's just a ploy by the powerful to deceive people to believe that. And like the brother Anthony just alluded to, as long as you don't have a frame of reference in terms of to make some kind of comparison in terms of the kind of statements that emanate in society, then there's no way that you can adequately determine for yourself the legitimacy of what's being said. So I think it's just a trick by those in power. So no, hell no, he did not bless America.
Brother Zimbabwe. Has God bless America?
He has stated, I feel like this is just part of a propaganda routine where you catch this catchy slogan, you can put on pins, you can put on a T-shirt, They even reflect it in the movies. If you notice, all of a sudden, recently this year, they've gone back to this whole white Jesus thing. And if you read your Bible, you know, they say Jesus had hair, wool. You know, he was of a darker brown hue in terms of complexion. So, you know, if they're not going to even acknowledge him for who he is, what is that but empty words?
Brother Moses, has God bless America?
Let me just say from the jump, to be ideologically sound, God and the devil, you can't exist simultaneously. East and the West cannot meet. North and South cannot meet. It's an oxymoron. So as God is an ideological concept and as a spirit, God has blessed the whole planet because we're still here. But in terms of America, I think there's a good book that just came out first of all, Howard Zinn's book, which came out about, you know, years ago, talking about the people's history of the United States. That was a good book. Now there's a book out by Horn called The Counter-Revolution of 1976. And it explains about, how the great Satan is the great Satan, basically, I mean, to sum it up. The counter-revolution of 1776, it put this whole thing in perspective. The power to define is the power to rule. If we accept the bourgeoisie's definitions and the owning class definitions, then we're always going to be subjected and acquiescent and complicit. But we have to look at the world and have our own view of the world, and that's why these books are so important. Because this is critical. Without revolutionary theory, there can be no revolutionary movement.
Okay, Bamboo, before we go down and break it in, we hold up our phone lines when we come back. Dear God bless America. What's your position?
Just quickly, I'd like to admit that I'm not a religious person, but from looking at religions, what I see is that most religions try to make mankind better, except maybe for a few. Hinduism, for example, which regulates a caste of people to a certain situation in society, no matter how they come, they can never change it. They have to live with it until they die and then hope they don't come back as that same caste. But religion in general seeks to make man better, and even the Bible itself talks about how to do good to make better for society. So I think that it would be absurd to say that some religion blesses one country over another country, or even one religion over another religion. I think that here again is the essence of your discussion this evening. Do people really want to know the truth? Because I would say again that to find the truth, we cannot just say that some people are suffering, oppressed, exploited, etc., because they're not blessed, because they're not lucky, because they're born on the wrong sign, that kind of stuff. So the objective reality, the essence of your discussion comes into play once again.
Okay, fine. We'd like to let our listening audience know that we're going to be taking a station break. When we come back, we'd like for you to chime in on this particular fundamental question, but it's an important question. Do the people really want to know the truth? And when we come back, we're going to ask our panelists, what happens or what is the assumption? Or why is it important to know the truth? Because even if it's the truth that once people know the truth, where they act upon it. We can have no discussions and more. When we come back, we're going to take a break. We're going to Africa with Roy Arabs. And when we come back, we'll continue discussion. Don't go away. You listen to Africa on the Move with your host, Brother Africa.
Center of the world. Latitude zero. Longitude zero. Planned by the Creator. Sizanthropus was the first man found on the earth. That earth was the motherland, Africa. We know that without total understanding of what happened in the past, it would be difficult to relate to the future. We know that within the structure of the music, there should be a message, and the message should be truth. So now, we give you the center of the world.
Yes, we'd like to apologize to our listening audience. We have some minor technical difficulties, but we had them resolved now. We thank you for your patience. We are back. You just recently listened to Africa is the Center of the World. And when someone talks about Africa is the Center of the World, which was produced by Roy Ailes, many times when we use the word center, we talk about nucleus. Now, just by making that statement, Africa is the center of the world, when we talk about nucleus, one may argue that that is an objective fact, that is true. And since we're trying to arrive at what is the truth, and will the truth set us free, let's just have this discussion right now. And we also have opened up our lines to 323-679-0841 for people to call in and get their perspectives on Will the truth, do the people really want to know the truth? So feel free to call in if you want to make a comment or have a question for our panelists. Make sure you hit number one. Hit number one. And we acknowledge your last four numbers. Just press number one. So we'd like to thank everybody for the break. Brother Hakeem, you know, we just listened to the statement by sign that was made by Roy Ailes called Africa is the Center of the World. When someone makes that statement for you, what does that mean to you as it relates to the reality of the historical development of mankind to the rest of the world?
Well, I think it's indicative of the fact that, you know, all things revolve around Africa. When we talk about the Omega, the beginning and the end, then we talk about Africa. Africa is where all the civilization begins. It is, when we talk about science, we talk about math, we talk about education, we talk about all those things, they have the origin in Africa. So, when we talk about African people, we're talking about the kings and queens or the mothers and fathers of our civilization, and we've never seen on that. Also, that for those individuals that are more into the science, in terms of, you know, when we talk about at one point where all the continents merged, that Africa was played a pivotal part in terms of, you know, making ensuring that human beings throughout Africa were able to move to different parts of this planet prior to the landmass splitting up. So Africa is similar in terms of the evolution or the contributions of the human being in terms of civilization. So Africa is key to is simply key to life.
Okay, Brother Bambushi, what does that statement mean to you when one says Africa is the center of the world?
Well, I think that what it means for me more so is a wish that, you know, we wish it was the center of the world and that it has the potential to be the center of the world. And in that sense, I'm not saying that it would be the ruler of the world, but instead a place in the world that people could look towards for social and political and economic freedoms and justice that does not exist today. So that's how I would see it. Now, here again, if you're talking about reality, that is not a reality. Today, Africa suffers from neocolonialism, and it's exploited in every inch of the continent. There's either exploitation or packs of hungry neocolonialists waiting to vamp on it and exploit it. The few countries that are not on the vicious neocolonial exploitation today are suffering from the threat of vicious neocolonial exploitation like Zimbabwe, like Eritrea, places like that. So in that sense, I would not say that today this is the reality of Africa. I would say that potentially it could become, and it could only become if we make a concrete effort to organize and mobilize to make it that. It will not become so if we just sit back and hope or sit back and pray. We have to do things to make that happen, and that's what we should be about doing.
Okay, again, we'd like to remind our viewers, you are listening to Africa on the Move. Our phone lines are open. You can call us at 323-679-0841. Please press 1 if you have something that you'd like to say. If you have a question or a comment, please press 1 so we can acknowledge your last four numbers. Now, in terms of continuing our discussion, the fundamental question when we start off is that do people really want to know the truth? And we discussed that possibility, what it means, and the realities. Now, let's take the flip side of that question. The assumption is once the people knows the truth or has learned the truth, it will cause them to act. We assume maybe it will cause them to act responsible. Has anyone found that to be a true in terms of even when the people know the truth, does it mean that they will act responsibly? Brother Anthony, would you address that from your perspective?
Not necessarily. Because, I mean, we have some Africans among us that know the truth, but yet choose to serve the interests of capitalism and neocolonialism. For their own selfish interests. Obama and Pernille Joseph being a couple of cases in point. Now, on the other hand, there are people that know the truth that have used their knowledge to try to advance the interests of the masses of the people, such as Kwame Nkrumah, Sekou Touré, and Kwame Touré, Marcus Garvey, et cetera. So my experience, it really depends upon where the interest of the individual lies as to what interest they choose to serve. And it is a choice. Make that clear. It's a choice of once you know the truth, whose interests are you going to serve? Are you going to serve the interests of the majority of our people, or are you going to serve the interests of a few? So it comes down to that struggle between socialism and capitalism.
That's interesting. You said even knowing the truth, people may not respond. Really, the driving point would be one's interest. Brother Moses, what is your position? Once you have given the people the truth, they know the truth, will they act or respond responsibly? What is your position on that?
Well, yeah, that's the key issue. Who has believed our report? That is the issue. Once you proclaim something, or you declare something, or you say this is reality, the question is who's going to accept it and who's not going to accept it. That's always the issue. It's a two-line struggle between socialism and capitalism, like the brother said. It's between the owning class and the working class, and the ideas that are going to perpetuate and advance the cause of the working class versus the ideas that are going to perpetuate and advance the cause of the owning class. And it's a two-line struggle. And so this struggle is, it's going to continue until one side wins out and dominates. Right now, the future is bright. Today is struggle, but the future is bright.
Okay, I want my brother Haki Jabari and Ram Bush to hold on for a second. We'd like to give our callers some opportunities maybe to shine in on this question. Do the people really want to know the truth? And even if they know the truth, will they respond appropriately? We're going to give our callers by calling out your last four numbers. We'd like to hear your views or comment. Do we have a comment or a question from call number, last four numbers, number 0673, caller 0673. Would you like to make a question or a comment, please?
A comment, brother.
Okay.
Lee?
Yes, brother. Any question or comment, please, you'd like to make?
I got a comment.
Okay, go ahead.
Yeah, people knowing the truth will not necessarily act on that truth because our worldview is based on culture. In this particular instance, the dominant culture, the Western culture. And when we hear information that contradicts our worldview, the insecurity we feel is called cognitive dissonance. So we're either going to ignore the truth and eventually deny it. The only thing that's going to wake us up is survival. Survival cancels out programming. That's why when you look at the mafia and groups like that, if you don't wake up, they got ways of making you wake up. And we don't see ourselves being attacked. In the 60s, with us being hosed down and the police dog, we saw ourselves being attacked. So we woke up. But we don't see ourselves being attacked today. We see that having an African in the White House as somehow we have arrived. So, no, not necessarily will they wake up because they hear the truth, because, as I mentioned earlier, our worldview is based on our culture. And our culture in this society is the dominant culture, Western culture. And when a brother Africa and Brother Haki gives a person information that contradicts that worldview, it's a natural tendency to reject it. It's like if somebody told you that your wife was having an affair, it's your natural instinct to reject that. No matter how much evidence someone comes up with, you're going to reject that. And so that's what's happening in this case here.
Okay, Brother Black, thank you for your comment. Continue to listen to the program. If you have any more comments before we leave that way, please just hit number one. Okay, let's try our next caller, see if they have any comments they would like to make. We have caller number 9047. Caller 9047, you're on Africa on your move. Any question or comments you'd like to make? Caller 9047. Okay, I think they just want to listen to the program. Let's go to our next caller. We have caller 3662. Caller 3662. Question or comment, please? Yes, caller, you're on Africa on the Moon. Your question or comment?
Yes, I would like to make a comment. And my comment is about the truth. And I think you're looking at, I agree with everything that's been said all along about the truth. Once you have the truth, will you accept the truth, number one, or is your cultural worldview different than that? Do you believe the truth or not? Some people just frankly don't believe the truth. Then there are those who know the truth, and do they respond to the truth? Some will not respond to the truth, and some will respond to the truth. And those who sometimes don't respond to the truth, it's for several different reasons. It may be because of fear. It may be because of economic sanctions that they know will follow. And it even can mean that if you respond to the truth, that you lose your life for it. And simply speaking, some people are not willing to lose their lives to respond to the truth. They are satisfied with living in the condition in which we find ourselves in this day and age. And so I think all of that is very relevant about the truth, and then people making the decision on belief of it or how they're going to respond to it, if they're going to respond to it. And the unfortunate thing is that we all have those decisions to make. However, if we don't respond to the truth on some level, and I'm not one of those who believe that we all have to look at the truth and believe and respond to it in the same manner, but at least if you are going to respond to the truth, please, I say, let me respond to it in the manner and operate in the truth in the manner in which I want to respond to it. And what I think happens oftentimes is that people are just not willing to allow everyone to respond to the truth in which they want to respond to the truth in. So, for instance, we have those who have such a great buy-in or economic tie-in to their house, their car, their clothes, that they are willing to bludgeon down those who want to respond to the truth in a very radical way. Rather than them staying and remaining neutral, they effectively go out. And these are those individuals who are in position of, quote, power, but their power only goes as far as to another African-American individual. So that's kind of how I'm thinking about that. The fear factor.
Thank you for your comments, but I would like to ask you one quick question, just get a general response from you. How do you deal with this issue of when one knows the truth? And when the collective knows the truth, how do you balance this issue of a individual response versus a collective group response? Because you stated something about you believe that one should be allowed the right to maybe to respond or act as an individual on its own time and pace. But a lot of times when you're dealing with movements, when you're dealing with things that need to be done, it becomes more important. But for some time, you may have to give up your individual response and go more of a response to be in the best interest of the collective. How do you balance those two?
That's a very good question. And me personally, I'm more into trying to find those individuals with whom I can collaborate with whom I can work with, to provide more unity, strength, I believe, I would say. So I think, I mean, therein lies the whole sacrifice as well. The individual response, if you can't find others who are like-minded, you have to go on with what you know and do that. I live in Minnesota, and I don't find that there are a lot of people that at this time and point, 2014, who have the same value system that I might have. Very, very few, particularly in the African American community. And so in many instances, and it's kind of always been that way, I've been there for 27 years almost, and well, I have been there 27 years, I guess almost. But there used to be more people there that were on that, they were on the same, I guess, kind of track level. But there are far and few between now. And so you find yourself in an individual way and manner. And so what I find myself doing, this is just me, I reach out across other state lines to talk to and to find people and then look at some of the strategies that they're using in order to, I guess, complement what I'm trying to do, what I'm trying to accomplish there, and then handing that over to the younger group. And I know a lot of people, they talk about the organizations that are very, I guess, obsolete or whatever, or they don't serve the community, like the NAACP Urban League, National Action Network. But I think that there's a place for those organizations. And what to me is most valuable is that when one can start a chapter in their community and be effective with another group, with other people, and you have a group of people, whether it's a group of 5, 7, 12, 25, 30, that will actively engage in some kind of just movement for our people, then we can do that. And I'm going to give you a case in point. There's a Reverend Dr. Barber. He's the NAACP president in North Carolina. I think he's been pretty darn effective. But yet people will say, well, the NAACP doesn't do anything. Well, we're you know, on a corporate level, they have some things that they certainly need to be looking at and improving upon. But at the same time, that chapter there, I mean, if I were living near him, I would certainly be involved in that, you know. And so I think collectively those particular organizations can do that. And I know in Minneapolis we started a NAN chapter that, and it's a group of people that's not your kind of people that necessarily be seen as a fan of the leader, but we like to try to do something collectively. And so I think you have to just do what you can do under certain circumstances. So I think in terms of the question that you're saying, I think collective actions are so much more stronger, and they're great. And by the way, the United Negro College Fund, I just have to say this, and I know it's a little bit off base of what we're talking about. Recently, I understand, I was reading some articles from Dr. Holloman, who sent them to me, and she said that United Negro College Fund just accepted $25 million from the Koch brothers. And we all know that the Koch brothers are not the best interest of African-American people. And we know that's a co-opted move. And you look at that and you think, and I know a couple of 3 months ago I was reading an article and they were crying and bellyaching about their condition, and that they were on the brink of financial challenges and difficulties, and yet there was no outcry to the community to help, but all of a sudden you've got $25 million that you're willing to sell that organization for, and the executive director of that should be ashamed of himself. Because the Koch brothers now will be sitting at the table making decisions on those scholarships, because for that $25 million, they have to have a representative from their standpoint to be sitting at the table to make those decisions. I think that was a terrible move for that gentleman to make within that organization, and it's a sad case for a college fund.
I thank you for your comments and your information, sister. And matter of fact, we can maybe talk a little bit about that as relates to our theme, our topic. We'll put you on hold. If you need to come back, just hit one, please. We thank you again. This is question addressed. I'd like to have Belboshi, Haki, and Jabari respond to this question. The sister just made a statement, which I really interested in terms of your response, about truth and reality. Let's say the reality is the Negro Culture Fund is close to bankruptcy. That's the reality. Let's say the truth is they got access to money, someone willing to give them money, but the money may not favor their politics. How do you address issues when it comes to what's making issues in the best interest of your well-being? At the same time, understanding the possibility of extinction. How do you address that phenomenon? Was there an error for them to accept the money from the Koch brother? Let's look at that phenomenon. This is something oppressed people face all the time. How would you deal with that, Brother Belboshi?
Well, our organization, the All African People's Revolutionary Party, has been a very poor organization for its almost entire existence, primarily because we refuse to accept any funds from the U.S. government or any part of it, and corporate America. And as such, we understand the dilemma that groups face, especially people who are non-GOs, non-governmental organizations, who primarily exist because their staff and their leadership are paid through the organization's budget. And part of their existence has to be constantly trying to see how they can raise funds. But what this also means is that they're now beholden to major corporations and to the United States government for their political positions, and they have placed their economic situation way above their political situation, and as such, it becomes a setback for them, a holdback for them. So while I can understand why many organizations do it, I disagree with why they do it.
Okay, Brother Haki, what is your position on that decision?
There's no question about it. They're in the dilemma. And the reality is they've always accepted government money, and increasingly so, they even accept money from corporate America. Of course, that spells real doom for the curriculum in terms of African universities, in terms of being able to impart certain kind of information. So I think that African universities have to think in terms of, they have to think overtly. I think one of the things they have to do, be very cognizant of the kind of people it allows to teach at the universities. I think information has to be conveyed surreptitiously without the powerful necessarily understanding the kind of information that's being imparted. It doesn't allow African historical black college and universities off the hook in terms of complicity. Clearly, when you take these people's money, they expect something in return. In fact, when we look at in terms of the erosion of
you know, African American studies, you know, at these historical black universities, it gives you calls for, you know, to pause. So clearly, there is, it's a dilemma. But I think that the dilemma has to be balanced with the fact that you got a lot of kids out here, African kids out here, who a lot of them are impoverished backgrounds, who want to get a college education. So I think that if we can afford to give them a college education, then I'm all for that. I think it's one of those kinds of arrangements I have to hold my nose at in terms of, you know, thinking about the broader good in the sense that at least these kids have access to higher education. So I think under circumstances, I would take the money, but I also understand that I would have to fight back surreptitiously now in a way in which those donors don't understand precisely what's going on, you know, so as to not to interrupt that money stream. But it's a very difficult situation for historical black colleges and universities.
Shabari?
Well, first and foremost, I'd like to say I'm not surprised by this because I've recently read an article about the Congressional Black Caucus, and the article was saying that there were several members that were upset because there was going to be a report to come out that was going to talk about how they accepted funding from people like the Koch brothers and major telecom companies to have certain votes on certain measures in Congress. And the reason that they were upset about this was basically going to reveal the hypocrisy that exists within the black misleadership class that keeps getting elected to Congress time and time again. Because not so much that they are about progress, but they're very good at manipulating and getting people to believe in the illusion, which is far from reality.
Okay, that's interesting. That goes on all the time, and it goes on ever since their resistance are coming here. But let's continue to move on. I think one of the fundamental questions again we were dealing with before we took off our break was the question of once the people do know the truth, the assumption is they will act accordingly to the truth. I don't think we had a chance to hear. Actually, we didn't have a chance to hear Ben Bush's position on the question in terms of the importance of once people learn the truth. What should we expect from that? Do that automatically mean they will act in response to the truth, or does it take more?
I think that to understand the truth, to know the truth, is the beginning. And we have to have a beginning. But it must be more. And I think that once we begin to know the truth, then as man, as a social being who lives in societies and communities and groups, then once we know the truth, we have to come together in the form of some form of social organization. And for me, the best form of social organization to come together and to change political and economic reality is to form a political party. And I would even go further to say it must be an independent, international, socialist party. And for us, it would have to be an African party. So I think that, you know, knowing the truth alone is the beginning step. It's just the beginning step. We have to move forward. But it's a priority. And we need to know the truth so that we can move forward.
Brother Moses, once the people know the truth, will they act responsibly? If not, what would it take?
Yeah,
Brother Moses.
Yeah.
What do you think? Do you buy into the assumption once the folks know the truth, they will act responsibly? And if not, what would it take to make them do so?
Well, first of all, it's necessity that pushes forth the social order. And so we need companionship, food, clothing, and shelter. So we are forced to some ideas and recognize the value of some ideas just in order to survive, in order to get that food, clothing, and shelter, we're forced and to submit to certain ideas. And again, it's a class, a working class, that's advocating for itself. We need food, clothing, and shelter. That's a right that we should have in terms of education and health care in particular. Those are rights that we should have. Now, that's the truth, but who has accepted that it's truth, and can we enforce that truth on the social order? You know, it's one thing to say it's the truth, but we got to make it work. And like I said, the power to define is the power to rule, and without revolutionary theory, there can be no revolutionary movement.
You know, Brother Anthony, I would argue the truth is among us as a people is we are African people. But our people don't want to hear that. Give us some understanding of how can we resolve this issue of bringing to the clarity of our people that we are African people, period. How do we make the people see the truth to that?
Let's see. I think history is the key. And I think understanding, our current reality, that our great revolutionary Malcolm X pointed out, that we're oppressed because we're Africans, above all else, in spite of whatever differences we might have ethnically, religiously, linguistically. We are oppressed because. The capitalists wanted our labor and they wanted control of our land, Africa. And that reality can be seen today in the fact that the struggle for the control of Africa resources is intensifying at a very quick rate. And yet it seems that people are more disorganized than ever. But I think we have to awaken people to that reality, that if Africa is liberated, free, and unified under a socialist government, that it would be in a position to protect the interests of Africans everywhere, and that the interests of Africans throughout the world would improve, wherever they are. And a case in point, can be seen with the situation in China. Once the Chinese got control of China, Chinese people were organized, and they were able to improve their situation and gain the respect of the world. But we have to intensify our level of organization. And I think that's the most important work that Pan-Africanists worldwide have to be engaged in today.
Brother Hakeem? Brother Malcolm often stated that on his Crying Africa, which reduces Crying Africa no matter where yet. Is that a truth or that's a mythology, or myth, and how do we get our people to see that connection, that importance, of making Africa primary in their lives when you're talking about struggling?
Well, you know, if our people don't understand the primacy of Africa, certainly the enemy understands the primacy of Africa. And so today we got organizations, military formations in Africa, in particular AFRICOM, running around to destabilize the African countries. And for what? It's the control of their resources. So Africa has a tremendous amount of power. It has a tremendous amount of resources in which if under the correct tutelage, could do wonders in terms of changing this whole paradigm that exists in the world, one from the capitalist predatory system to a socialist system which, you know, food, shelter, education would be guaranteed, or would essentially be a different paradigm in which the humanity be in a position to actually love and not hate, to actually build, not destroy. And with respect to this question of destroy, I think it's very, very important to understand that if Africa doesn't gain control of the resources, that the planet is essentially doomed. Because as the current global economic system, who is blinded by the pursuit of profits, has no understanding or no concern
in terms of, you know, global temperature changes that are wrecking the planet atmosphere and as well as the ecological systems of the planet. They don't care about that. What is primary for them is the pursuit of money. And the thing that people should be angry about is the fact that this is our planet. This planet does not belong to the capitalist class. It belongs to all people on this planet. And we should be indignant about the fact that there are some people or few people, less than a few people, who are actually, despite the warning signs in terms of global warming and the ill effects it has on the planet, they're sick and they're doing things, you know, that destructed the planet in the pursuit of making money. So clearly we have a vested interest in terms of shaping what goes on in Africa. We only can do that by recognizing, you know, our relationship to Africa. We have a relationship to Africa, whether we understand it or not. If we're self-hating, we think that Africa is somehow backwards and irredeemable, then we need to start reading to precisely understand the contributions of Africa, the power that Africa wields, and the richness in terms of Africa being able to actually shape the destiny of human beings. So we have with a free and strong, independent Africa, then you can be assured that Africans throughout the world will be respected. Throughout diaspora, they will be respected. So it's very key, very, very important, not only for political reasons, but for economic and social reasons, that we have a strong and unified socialist Africa. That's extremely important for our people.
Brother Jabari, when we talk to the African youth in our community, what should be the first thing we should say to them as it relates to stop this violence thing among the youth? That would be truthful.
Okay. First thing I would say is that you're much better off unified. And what I mean by that is that given the contributions that your ancestors have made to society, the ability that you all would have as a collective is endless. There's so much possibility. Don't see yourselves as strangers. Don't see yourselves as adversaries. Don't see yourselves as being harmful to one another. But understand that there's great influence when you all are able to work together.
Okay. Point well said. And dear Brother Bamboshi, we have a history that exists over hundreds of years of the Pan-African movement. We know the first Pan-African Conference took place in 1900, but there were even movements, you know, prior to that point of looking at Africans coming together collectively. Now, given the fact we do have a history of this Pan-African movement, how do we use this movement today to sell it to our people to make them think this is something realized, it's something where African people all can come together to fight for the betterment of Africa? And start looking at ourselves and being disconnected. How do you sell to people that, based upon reality, that we face on a daily basis?
Well, I think it's clear that the first thing is organization, that the major problem we have as a people, we lack revolutionary political organization. I think our second most important question is the question of political consciousness. How do we develop within our people this revolutionary political consciousness that will be needed to wage a revolution? And, of course, this, again, consciousness implies that we have organization. So organization is key. That's one. Secondly, I think that the question of how do we relate to Africa comes from what you've been discussing all evening so far, the question of the truth. What is the truth? Did we come as imperialist invaders to this hemisphere to commit genocide against the Indians and to steal their land, or were we brought here in a similar fashion to work this land as slaves for the people who came to steal the land from the red man and commit genocide against him? So I'm saying that once we begin looking for the truth, we will see that Africa, for us, for the Africans in the diaspora and the Africans at home, must become a priority, because once Africa is properly organized, liberated, and united, then it puts us, the African, especially the African in the diaspora, in an entirely different perspective, no matter where we live in the world. And so this perspective will give us the impetus we need, the respect we need, the liberation we need, the unity we need. So for us today, one of our primary objectives must be working towards the total liberation and unification of Africa. Now, people say, well, what happened to the little local struggles that we are involved in? What happened to the small national struggles that we're involved in? What happened to the microstate struggles that we're involved in? These must be carried out also. But our primary objective must be the total liberation and unification of Africa under an all-African socialist government.
Okay, and given the notion I've stated that, this leads us right into talking a little bit about, the significance of an individual who was born on this date, June 29, 1941, that the world knows as Kwame Ture, formerly known as Tucker Carmichael. He'll be, basically, this is his 73rd birthday if he's still living. In terms of day being his birth, the date that he was born on, can each one of y'all maybe talk a little bit about the realities of how do you see the contribution and the value of the work of Brother Kwame Ture? We start with you, Brother Anthony.
Okay. The value of his work, I think, is immeasurable in terms of his contribution toward the liberation of Africans and Africa. His work and the organizations that he worked with during the course of his political life, such as SNCC, the Black Panther Party, the All African People's Revolutionary Party, had a profound impact on our lives that I think a lot of people tend to take for granted. I mean, the fact that a lot of us were able to get a college education is owed to the fact that the struggles of SNCC and numerous other organizations opened up access of the college campuses to Africans who were not able to get that. And also his work on the identity question and his emphasis on uniting in spite of our various differences. But I think the most important legacies he left behind were the importance of identity, the fact that we're all African no matter what part of the world we find ourselves in, and the importance of being organized.
Brother Haki?
Yeah, Brother Kwame was the epitome of perseverance. You really got to respect the brother in terms of principle, and also his love for our people. It's not easy. I mean, he came up at a time in which we talk about a great deal of among our people in terms of struggling to be free currently, but when we look at it in time when Kwame actually operated, the resistance was probably even greater in terms of our people to confront these institutions that oppress them. So you got to take a hit off to him in terms of his perseverance. Also, you got to respect him for in terms of his intellectual growth and his willingness to understand that at some point, people outgrow organizations all the time, but the love for your people persists. And so therefore, you want to find organizations that you feel truly, to the maximum extent, benefit the aspirations of the people. So, you know, when in terms of focusing on Africa, in terms of building a strong Africa, this is something that will resonate with all African people, irrespective of where they live in the diaspora. So Kwame was very, very bright in terms, very, very intellectual, and I respect him a great deal for that, and his legacy will live on.
Brother Moses. Do we still have you, Brother Moses? Okay, let's move to Brother Bambushi.
Yes, sir.
What is the legacy and contribution you think that Brother Kwame Ture should be recognized or be remembered by?
Kwame was a, I think, honest and humble man. He kind of was an example of what Nkrumah called the new type of African, the new type of citizen that Africa needed. An honest, modest, informed man, a man who would submerge his own personal interests for the interests of Africa and the people, its people. I think Kwame was also a very complex man. He was an international man. Kwame opened our eyes to a lot of other struggles that were taking place around the world, who had similar problems that we did, that we never knew about because the corporate media in the United States never informed us about these struggles and the people who were waging them and why. But in general, I think Kwame's greatest contribution was the contribution he made to current contemporary Pan-Africanism. And I think that that struggle, like Brother Haki said, was based on the fact that Kwame had an undying love for his people, and he said it. He always said it. He was not bashful about that question. And so, as such, to understand Kwame is also to understand Pan-Africanism and to understand why Pan-Africanism. So we see again the reality of theory, Kwame's theory, and the reality of practice. Because while Kwame realized that we needed Pan-Africanism, he became the foremost proponent of pushing for that struggle, that objective, that goal. And he made such an impact that everywhere you look where this discussion takes place around the question of Pan-Africanism, if he is not placed in the center of that discussion, if he's not mentioned as part and parcel of that discussion, then the discussion becomes questionable. It becomes bogus. It becomes unhistorical. So, therefore, I think that the whole question of Kwame Ture and his role in our struggle for Pan-Africanism is an issue that probably would have to be dealt with on a show by itself. It's not a question that we could really adequately give any real serious analysis to in a few minutes. And in essence, that's what I think.
And in reference to your point, we concur with your brother Bambushi, and we'll do that in the near future. But we thought it'd be very important for this particular program just to acknowledge his existence in terms of his birthday. So always, we are never ungrateful for those who have done so much for us. and Brother Kwame have made great contributions to our people moving forward. We have only a few minutes left. We may go over a few minutes. What we would like to do is alert our listening audience and those who may be online listening to Africa on the Move, that if you want to hear the entirety of this program, you always can go to our archive by going to www.blogtalkradio.com/Africa-on-the-move. Or you can tune in right now. You can dial 323-679-0841. That's 323-679-0841. And you'll get a chance to hear the entirety of this whole program. Right now, what I would like to do is, Brother Haki, I know you've been an advocate of a particular case dealing with a young brother in Colorado. When we talk about the truth dealing with reality, I would like for you to just take a few minutes to share with our audience one of the realities that is taking place in Colorado today with a young brother named Michael Fulton. At the same time, this is just symbolized the difficulties and oppression that African youth have been faced under this capitalist system all over the country, all over the world, in terms of this prison incarceration. Can you just talk a little bit about his case? Because we will hope that once the people hear the truth, we will hope and we are seeking that they are to act responsibly in terms of trying to help this brother, sister, this brother and others. Can you just talk a little bit about this case, Brother Haki?
Yeah, the young brother, Michael Fulton, he's a graduate of the University of Colorado as a math major, a very bright young man. Anyway, he was the unfortunate recipient of a computer-generated virus from someone else's computer onto his computer. There was an image left on his computer in which the law enforcement tapped into, and they charged him with having child pornography images on his computer. Now, the thing for Michael is to prove that those images did not come from his computer but were emanated from elsewhere. But the problem is that it takes a tremendous amount of money to get a computer forensic analyst to look at the hard drive, to examine the hard drive, to tell you exactly where the images come from and where and what location it came from. The prosecutor is playing hardball. He only wants to give the family access to a disk. Now, anybody know anything about a computer know a disk simply won't cut it. You need to examine the hard drive, but this is what he's doing. His position is that to allow them access to the hard drive is to re-victimize the children who images are on the hard drive. Of course, that's absurd, but legally it's justifiable. Unfortunately, you know, he can use that as a legal tactic. But again, this brother, because of the fact that he's indigent, he's poor, stands a real chance that he may end up in prison along with countless other innocent men simply because they're impoverished. One of the things is that in this country, over 80% of the people, poor defendants or indigent, are represented by public defenders. And, of course, we understand public defenders have no vested interest in terms of pursuit of justice simply because they don't have the resource nor time to dedicate to cases. So as a consequence, they normally pressure these young men to plead to guilty. And so this is a dilemma confronting Michael Fulton. So we're struggling hard, we're fighting hard, you know, to educate people in terms of a particular case and get people to understand that this can happen to anybody. That when these pedophiles, you know, create these encrypted messages, these files, and they send them out, they can land on anybody's computer. Irrespective of the kind of software you have in terms of detecting viruses, this technology, sonographic software, very intricate, very complex software in terms of bypass or deceive people into believing that the computer is doing one thing when in fact it's doing something else. So, for instance, you may see a warning sign come up stating that a driver is not working and that do you want the computer to repair it? You may click on yes. Well, that might mean you open the door to these viruses in terms of planting thousands of files on your computer. And not only that, botnets, literally, this technology can encrypt literally tens of thousands of files at a time on your computer. So this is a danger in terms of computer technology, and while all people have to be cognizant of and concerned about this. Now, when we talk about getting a computer analyst, forensic analyst, we're talking about a lot of money. On average, we're talking about, at a minimum, we're talking about anywhere from $25,000 to $100,000 for a computer forensic analyst. So it's very, very expensive. So needless to say, a lot of prosecutors throughout the country have no vested interest in real justice. They have a vested interest in winning because most of them want to pursue high office. And so this is the fundamental contradiction that we're confronted with and that all people have to be concerned about. So in any event, Brother Lee can give you, Brother Africa can give you the information in terms of, you know, if you want to assist in his defense, where you could go in terms of doing that. But this is, again, a situation which, you know, we have to be concerned about. And none of us can sleep safely because this can happen to any of us. And keep in mind also that this is a $1.3 billion industry. So the IT companies who are well aware of this propensity for pedophiles to send these files surreptitiously to other computers, they're aware of that, but they're not willing to invest the kind of money in terms of preventing it. So that means everybody's vulnerable. So we have to understand that very clearly.
And the bottom line is, you know, race and money is a fundamental issue in the justice system in this country. And what we're asking friends, supporters, and people is to share the story with your network. And we're asking them to, if they can send any kind of donation contribution to Save Our Sons Defense Fund, Inc. at P.O. Box 58, Inglewood, Colorado, zip code 80151. They'll send your donation contribution to Save Our Sons Defense Fund, Inc. at P.O. Box 58, Inglewood, Colorado, 80151, or you can go to any Wells Fargo bank and make a deposit in the same account name and ask for the account number 848-252-7028. That's 848-252-7028 to any Wells Fargo account. Ask them that you'd like to make a deposit to Save Our Sons Defense Fund, and that would be greatly appreciated. That's number one. They definitely need your financial support so we can get together a legal team and a computer analyst to properly defend the Shum brother. This brother was on his way of becoming an educator. Number two, but more importantly, we need to help get the story out. And if you would like to have more information and documents on the story, we ask you to email saveoursons2013@gmail. That's saveoursons, with an S on it, 2013@gmail.com. His mother, Katie, is open to speak to anyone who have any concerns or questions. You can reach her at 720-499-5146. Her name is Katie Fulton, 720-499-5146. We're pleading for the community support of all just and loving people throughout the world. In closing, I would like to ask everybody the million-dollar questions where Sojourner Truth once stated that when she was on a freedom ride and she was trying to free the slaves, I mean her Tuckman, when she was trying to free the slaves, she said she freed 1,000 of them because she could have freed 1,000 more if they only knew they was enslaved. My question to everyone today, when we talk about this question, dealing with the truth and objective reality, are we anything more than a modern-day slave today of being a slave, understanding the nature of the fundamental issues that we are facing when we first came here to where we are now? If our people understand this as a reality, will this make us a lot more easy to organize and fight harder to eradicate the capitalist system? I start with Brother Anthony first.
I think it would make it a lot easier to organize and fight against the capitalist system. But as I mentioned earlier, the weapons that the bourgeoisie have are very powerful, and they dominate the thinking of our people, unfortunately. And we have to counter that with revolutionary ideology.
Brother Haki.
Yeah, we are slaves. And the problem, we're not only slaves, but we're increasingly becoming more and more expendable. As the wealth accumulates to the top continuously and nothing for the bottom, it means that our existence, as far as those in power are concerned, are esoteric. We've got to find a way to get rid of us. This is the dilemma that we're faced. We are slaves.
Brother Moses, are you still with us? I think we lost Brother Moses, Brother Bamboshi.
Yes, sir. I just think we need organization and we need political consciousness.
Okay. We do have some of our participants still online. We'll go down to them, see if they have any final thoughts on this question. Call 0673. What is your position on this last question?
No, I don't.
Okay. Let's go to caller 3662. What is your position on this last question? Caller 3662.
I think that we have to be continually searching for the truth, teaching the truth, and I still think we rise.
Okay. And we try for the last time for caller 9047. Question or comments that they may have. 9047. Okay, we thank them for their participation. We'd like to thank everyone for their participation. And we'd like to thank all those who allowed us to come to their homes today, this evening, to talk about this question. Do the people really want to know the truth? And how are we going to move our people forward to get a better understanding of that? Once we get a better understanding of that, and once we get a better understanding of what is the reality and how to respond when people do learn what the reality is, we'll be in a lot more better position to begin to plot a plan and move our people forward. Until next time, we'd like to thank you for listening to Africa on the Move. We'd like to tell you that this is a community project of African Awareness Association. And any kind of contribution that would like to be sent to African Awareness Association, please send it to P.O. Box 4433, Richmond, Virginia, 23221. Any questions or views concerning any of our shows, you can always write us at African_Awareness_Association@Yahoo. Until next time, let's strive to go forward ever and backward level. And we'll leave you like the way we came with Brother Bob. We're going to love our people no matter what. Until next time, let's continue. Listen to
table. See, I wanna love you. I wanna come and treat you. Come and treat you right. I wanna love you. The room.